Welcome to episode 7 for November 14th, 2006. We've got a great show. As always, we would never, ever deliver anything less than a great show because we care about you, our listeners. So we're going to keep on talking about James Bond today in part 5 of our James Bond segments. And in fact, Sam's going to give us a gadget recap, talking about all the great gadgets in all the Bond movies, which is something I'm dying to hear because that's my favorite part of the movies, I think. We're also going to talk about the unknown Quentin Tarantino film when we spotlight his underappreciated gem, Jackie Brown. We're also going to do top 6 list about the top 6 movies that you thought would be bad, but were not, which is sort of an interesting category because it says as much about Sam and I as it does about the movies themselves. And we're also going to have another DVD preview for you talking about some movies that are coming out this month and next month. I'm Stephen Keller.
And I'm Sam Stoddard, and wow, Stephen, that was a great introduction.
Thank you, I really tried.
I mean, I thought I was excited about this show before, but now, I mean, wow, this is such a great introduction. Could you do me a favor and do an encore performance of that intro?
Sure. Welcome to episode 7 for November 14th, 2006. We've got a great show. As always, we would never, ever deliver anything less than a great show because we care about you, our listeners.
For the last few weeks, we've been recapping the James Bond film series. This is the 5th and final installment in the series, although we will get to a little something extra next week. Anyway, today I want to go back and talk about the 2 previous versions of Casino Royale, which is Ian Fleming's first Bond novel, and then talk about the upcoming 3rd release, which stars Daniel Craig and opens November 17th. But first, I want to mention quickly an important aspect of the Bond films that I haven't really covered yet, and that is the cars, the guns, and the gadgets that appear throughout the series. These movies have more well-known props than any other movies I know, and while they're interesting, we have only so much time in the show, and there's only so much you can say about them, but just so we cover the bases, I'm going to zip right through the series again, starting with a deep breath. In Dr. No, Bond traded in his Beretta for the Walther PPK, which remains with him until Tomorrow Never Dies, when he had a Walther P99. From Russia with Love had the first novelty gadget, a briefcase with all kinds of secret compartments and weapons. The bad guy had a watch that could strangle people and a dagger shoe. Goldfinger was the first appearance of the Aston Martin DB5 with all kinds of fun accessories. This is the most iconic of all Bond cars, despite only appearing in 4 of the movies, 2 of them being in the Brosnan era, although several other Aston Martin models also appear throughout the series. Thunderball had a rebreather, a mouthpiece that pulls oxygen from the water, and 2 jetpacks, one for the air and one for underwater. You Only Live Twice had Little Nelly, an armed gyrocopter that breaks down into convenient travel-size containers. Honor Majesty's Secret Service had radioactive lint that functioned as a homing device. In Diamonds Are Forever, the vehicles of choice were a Ford Mustang and a moon buggy, and there's also a mousetrap you can put in your pocket just in case someone tries to search you. Live and Let Die had a magnetic watch that could deflect bullets and a coffee maker that makes coffee. Said M, is that all it does? The Man with the Golden Gun had an AMC Hornet, a car, plane, a prosthetic nipple, and a really stupid golden gun that only fires one bullet, although it does neatly break down into a cigarette lighter, case, cufflink, and pen. The Spy Who Loved Me had 1 ski pole gun, a Lotus Esprit that doubles as a submarine, and one of the first ever water bikes, now better known as jet skis. Moonraker had a lot of nonsense. For Your Eyes Only had another Lotus Esprit. Octopussy had a yo-yo saw and a personal submarine shaped like a crocodile. A View to a Kill had Snooper, a remote-controlled robot surveillance unit, a submarine iceberg, and most outrageous of all, polarized sunglasses. The Living Daylights had a Harrier, a sofa that eats people, and a keychain that does different things when you whistle at it. License to Kill had explosive toothpaste and an alarm clock guaranteed not to wake up anybody who uses it. GoldenEye had a BMW Z3, the first of a few BMW models, and also featured the Aston Martin DB5, also a killer phone booth. Tomorrow Never Dies had a BMW motorcycle and a mobile phone stun gun that can also analyze fingerprints. The World Is Not Enough had X-ray glasses, a machine gun bagpipe, and Q's personal submergible retirement boat. And finally, Die Another Day had Bond's 20th gadget watch, a mini rebreather, a surfboard equipped with various weaponry, and reappearances of several gadgets from previous films.
Nerd.
Okay, so back to Casino Royale. The book was written by Ian Fleming in 1953, and it was a darker novel than the sequels he would write, in particular containing a scene in which Bond is tortured in ways most men would prefer not to contemplate. Anyway, the novel was successful, and film and TV rights were sold to CBS. CBS adapted it as an episode of their Mystery Hour series called Climax. Bond was played by Barry Nelson, and the villain, Le Chiffre, was played by Peter Lorre. And this adaptation of Casino Royale changed the character of Bond in a way that would be absolutely unconscionable today, now that Bond is established as an iconic character. Namely, there's an American-English switch happening here. James Bond becomes American, and he's actually called Jimmy Bond. And Felix Leiter becomes Clarence Leiter, the British agent who works with him. Other than that, though, this is a pretty faithful version of the book. The show is performed live, and consequently there are a few hiccups here and there that are entertaining to see, missed cues and so forth. There is a story that Peter Lorre can be seen getting up and walking off stage after his character has supposed to be dead, but this is an urban legend. It did happen, just not with this episode. It happened in an earlier episode of Climax Mystery Theater during a presentation of Raymond Chandler's The Long Goodbye. Anyway, the show is, if not exactly involving in the way movies are, an interesting adaptation of Fleming's story.
Surprisingly, I have not seen the 1956 hour-long presentation on Climax Mystery Theater. Well, I know it's a real classic. I don't know how I missed it, but
probably because you were looking at a 1956 instead of 54, but it is on DVD, so you can,
well,
you can get it.
Rush out and get that. Yeah.
Okay.
Can't wait.
Now, the rights to Casino Royale go through several different hands over the years, and it's not until 1999 that they finally wind up in the hands of Eon Productions, thereby allowing the upcoming movie with Daniel Craig to be made. Actually, that's an interesting story, because Kevin McClory surfaces yet again, and he goes to Sony in the late 90s and said, hey, let's make our own Bond series. I have the rights to all of these drafts of Thunderball. Now, I always thought he could going to make a whole series of Bond films based on different drafts of the same story. I have no idea, but Sony took him up on it. And so MGMUA, the distributor of the Bond films, threatened legal action, and they settle out of court with an interesting trade of properties. Sony, which owns Columbia Pictures, which owned the rights to Casino Royale, gave them to MGM, and MGM, in turn, gave up its partial rights to Spider-Man, allowing Sony to move forward with its Spider-Man movie after years of legal problems getting it off the ground. Ironically, Sony would later purchase MGM, so Sony reacquired all these rights anyway. Also interestingly, MGMUA acquired the rights to Never Say Never Again in 1997 with its purchase of Orion Pictures, and so the end result is that I think all the Bond film rights are in one place for the first time ever. But let's go back to 1967. The rights to Casino Royale are changing hands, and they wind up with a producer named Charles K. Feldman, and his idea was to go to Broccoli and Saltzman, the producers of the official series, and ask if they want to collaborate on an official version of the story. Broccoli and Saltzman turn him down because they've just had a miserable experience working with McClory on Thunderball, and Feldman, thinking he could not compete with a serious adaptation, made a parody instead. This movie is really weird, actually, and a chaotic production resulted in a disjointed film. It has five different directors, and they were all working independently of each other, shooting different stories that would be later edited together. And these different pieces really don't have anything to do with each other. There's a little overlap, but not too much. The big marketing blitz was that there are seven James Bonds, and the reason there are seven is because the real James Bond has a master plan, and that is to codename all of their agents James Bond 007, so that Smersh would be so confused they won't know who to kill. Now, the three James Bonds that are important here are the regular one, played by David Niven, a real-life friend of Ian Fleming, and the guy Fleming originally wanted to play the role in the serious movies. Then there's Peter Sellers, who plays a guy impersonating James Bond for reasons that never get explained. And then there's, of all things, Woody Allen, playing Bond's nephew, Jimmy Bond, who is actually a Blofeld-like bad guy, much in the same spirit that Rick Moranis parodies Darth Vader in Spaceballs. Allen is easily the best part of this movie, displaying his comic persona to good effect, and it's interesting because Allen wasn't really all that well known at the time. He's probably best known for What's New, Pussycat, which he wrote and co-starred in, and it was also produced by Charles Feldman. In fact, there's a reference to it in Casino Royale, where the What's New, Pussycat song bursts out on the sound track for no apparent reason, but not the strangest thing in the movie Casino Royale.
So you're telling me a movie directed by five different directors, all working independent of one another, isn't cohesive? I would never have guessed.
I am saying that exactly. It's a shock, but it's true. One of those five directors was none other than John Huston. and he also plays M. The characters of Vesper Lind and Le Chiffre are played by Ursula Andress, the definitive Bond girl from Dr. No, and Orson Welles, who is really making some weird career decisions at this time.
Not as weird as Transformers, the movie, though.
Yeah, he went downhill from there. It's actually Peter Sellers impersonating Bond that confronts Le Chiffre at the Baccarat table in the scene from the book. Sellers and Welles hated each other so much that their scenes had to be filmed separately and stitched together in the editing room. And the other thing about Sellers is that he didn't want to be doing a parody at all. He wanted to play Bond for real, and so he kept trying to play it straight and rewriting all the goofy lines that the writers gave him. Well, all this tension with Sellers resulted in him storming off the set for days at a time, and eventually he was fired, which meant some really weird editing and story rewrites had to be done to fix the fact that his story arc didn't have a beginning or end. I think originally the movie was supposed to be all about him, and I think the five directors coming in and filming different storylines was to fill in for what Sellers had not finished. Ultimately, they just had Vesper Lind shoot Peter Sellers' character, and he's off-screen when he's getting shot, and there's never any explanation about why she did that, so they didn't really stitch things together that well. But you know what? As bad as this movie is, I actually love it. It's an embarrassment to say so, but this is a true guilty pleasure for me. It goes further over the top in the final battle than I think any other movie I know, and, you know, the Indians are parachuting in to go join the fight for no particular reason. I mean, that kind of thing. And actually, the movie has really good music, though, by Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass, a kind of very 60s comic score, sort of the feel of the Benny Hill theme music, for example, I guess. But it's incredibly catchy. And also the movie made a hit song out of The Look of Love by Dusty Springfield, which reappears in the Austin Powers series to satirize the Bond thing in the 60s and all that. But the music and Woody Allen's performances are the only pieces I actually call good. The rest is terrible, and, you know, I like it.
I've never actually been able to watch the entire movie. I've tried once or twice and just turned it off some way through.
Yeah, it's just chaotic and incoherent, yeah. So let's move back up to the present. After Die Another Day, Eon Productions decides that, as was the case with Moonraker back in 1979, the Bond series has gotten so far over the top that they just can't hold it together anymore, trying to always one-up the previous episode. Now, I like Die Another Day way more than Moonraker, but I kind of agree with that opinion. So, once again, the next Bond movie will be a back-to-basics sort of thing. This is the, you know, maybe the third or so time that they've done this to keep the series alive and adapting to the changing times. And we'll supposedly get a movie that's more of a character-driven spy story and less of a big spectacle. Kind of wish they hadn't replaced Pierce Brosnan. I think he still had some good performances in him. But I have to admit, Daniel Craig, perhaps best known for the British gangster film Layer Cake, looks like he'll be pretty good. He looks sharp and dangerous, much like Timothy Dalton. And I have to say, I thought Clive Owen would have been absolutely perfect, but I think Craig will do fine. But he was a controversial choice, and a lot of people just hate the idea. But we'll see what happens when people finally get to see him in the role. I think a lot of people who are down on him now might change their tunes.
Yeah, I'm kind of neutral on it, though, like you. Clive Owen, what a good choice. I don't know how it didn't happen.
Yeah, that's too bad.
Especially since Clive Owen basically plays James Bond in Sin City, or, you know, my fantasy version of James Bond.
Also, the higher short films made by BMW.
Absolutely. One of the things that was originally talked about with Casino Royale was the idea of Quentin Tarantino directing it. He was pushing, I guess, to do it, but...
You know, I think Casino Royale directed by Tarantino would have been fantastic.
I mean, he really wanted to, from what I understand, he really wanted to strip it down and make it pretty much true to the book, dark and gritty.
Yeah.
Would have been something to see.
And there have been other big directors who've been turned down over the years to do Bond. One was Steven Spielberg, and he was turned down to do a Bond movie by the producers, and so he went and created Indiana Jones because he wanted to make his own Bond movie, so he created this character that's actually quite different, but, you know, that was the motivation for Indiana Jones. Now, rather than integrating Casino Royale into the timeline of the other movies, for the first time we're going back in time. This story still takes place in the present day, but in this movie we'll see Bond when he's first made a 00 agent and given his license to kill, which is a little weird because he's given his license to kill by Dame Judi Dench's M, which doesn't really make sense because Dench is established as a successor to an earlier M that Bond worked for, but whatever. We're starting over and everything's new.
It's a different James Bond. They didn't tell you this is the James Bond from the parallel universe?
Yeah. So, other changes being made that are kind of weird, actually. The characters of Q and Moneypenny will not appear, and I think that was kind of a mistake. I don't think there's any reason to write these characters out, but that's what's happening. On the whole, though, I'm pretty excited about this. I like the Brosnan films, in some cases quite a lot, but to my mind, the constant action kind of thing was never really what I thought Bond was all about. I'd rather see that Bond films have a more subdued tone to them, a more realistic approach to the spy stories, even though they are sort of a parody of spy stories, as we talked about before. I think he works better when he's taking things a little more realistically, you know, perhaps a bit like the Jason Bourne movies with Matt Damon, that kind of tone to him.
Oh man, please don't say that. Don't say that out loud. I hate the Bourne movies.
You've only seen one of them.
And it was enough to make me know I hate
them. You saw the not very good one.
I don't care. I refuse to watch the other.
But it's, you know, it seems the filmmakers have the same idea, and I've long wanted to see a faithful version of Casino Royale in particular. The only thing that makes me pause is the choice to go with director Martin Campbell, who directed GoldenEye and the two Zorro movies with Antonio Banderas. I don't know how they can look at this guy and figure he can do a subdued suspense film. He's never done it. Nothing in his filmography even hints at it. You know, I think GoldenEye is successful kind of in spite of him, because as we talked about last week, the movie isn't put together that well. It's sort of a conflict of tones happening there. It was successful, it was a good movie, but I don't think that was really Martin Campbell's doing, and it's definitely not what he's supposed to be allegedly doing with Casino Royale coming up.
Yeah, I'm kind of worried about that myself. The trailer makes me a little nervous, too. There's lots of explosions, so I don't know.
Well, there are, but I think maybe the marketing would have highlighted those key scenes and cited them on their own just to make it look like a big action movie, so maybe we'll be okay still. In any case, we will find out shortly. November 17th is just around the corner, and next week we will feature a review of the film after both Steven and I have seen it on the opening weekend. So I guess we'll find out next week. And
so check back Tuesday, and you'll get the Steven and Sam review of the new Casino Royale, and I'm sure Sam will let us know how it compares to that famous mystery climax theater CBS show that he loves so well.
The object of this week's trivia question is to name the famous director I'm about to talk about in a short anecdote. Two French authors, Pierre Boileau and Thomas Narzajac, I'm not sure how to pronounce that last one. Anyway, they wrote a suspense novel called Celle qui ne taille plus, and director Henri-Georges Clouzot beat our mystery director to purchasing the film rights by a matter of mere hours. Now, Clouzot filmed the novel, and the movie was called Les Diaboliques, a classic French horror film from 1955. Well, a mystery director was so disappointed, and he asked the two writers to write a novel for him, and they did. The novel was called From Among the Dead, and our mystery director shot it, and the movie, which had a different title, became one of his most famous and respected films. So the question is, who is the director? Do you have an idea, Stephen?
Wait, what's a director?
Well, we will get back to you later in the show, and meanwhile, our listeners can see if they can figure out the answer for themselves. If you don't know it, you might be able to deduce it just based on the genre here and the time frame. So, we'll get back to this at the end of the show.
She's brown sugar and spice, but if you don't treat her nice, she'll put you on ice. At least, that's what the poster for Jackie Brown told us in 1997, which unfortunately set the wrong tone for director Quentin Tarantino's third movie, an ode to the 70s that also ended up being one of his most misunderstood films. I think it's worth doing a film spotlight on Jackie Brown, because while we talk a lot about Tarantino and he's pretty well-liked and well-regarded, you don't hear a lot about Jackie Brown. Now, it's sort of a 70s throwback movie, but not in the way you'd think. Tarantino is, of course, very famously obsessed with the 70s. His most recent film, Kill Bill, was a movie in two parts that was an ode to the 70s martial arts grindhouse pictures. But Jackie Brown is actually, despite its poster, which portrayed it as a blaxploitation movie from the 70s, is actually a very adult movie. It's a crime flick based on an Elmore Leonard novel, but Tarantino has extracted a lot from it. It's really more, in my opinion, a movie about aging and getting old and how you deal with it. Almost no campiness in it at all. It's very serious, and that's kind of unusual for Tarantino. A lot of the Tarantinoisms are toned down. The pop culture references are really, really reduced, and compared to his other movies, it's fairly conventional. And I think it wasn't what people expected. It got pretty mixed reviews when it was released on Christmas Day in 1997, and these days you don't really talk about it that much. I really believe it's unfairly overlooked. I think Quentin Tarantino is a great director. Sometimes he gets sort of a rap for making the same movie over and over. But that's not fair because Jackie Brown is a very different film from his other movies, even though it features a lot of his trademarks. But like I said, they've been toned down. So the movie stars Pam Grier, playing the titular character Jackie Brown, a stewardess who gets busted carrying money and a little bit of cocaine for arms dealer wannabe Samuel L. Jackson, who plays this thug who's moved into selling guns on the streets and trying to make it big. Robert Forster plays Max Cherry, the bail bondsman Jackson goes to bail Pam Grier's character out. The Forster and Grier characters have an interesting relationship that doesn't ever really quite bloom into romance, but feels like it might have under different circumstances. There are also some great small performances. Robert De Niro plays a stoned-out convict recently released from prison who is sort of a lackey for Samuel L. Jackson. And Bridget Fonda plays one of Samuel L. Jackson's women, whose tendency to say the wrong thing at the wrong time catches up with her in an unexpected way by the end of the film. Like I mentioned, it's based on an Elmore Leonard novel. Leonard is very famous for his crime novels and his great use of dialogue and his complicated plots. Tarantino did quite a bit of adaptation. He wrote the screenplay and moved, for instance, descending from Miami to Los Angeles. The basic setup for the story is, like I said, Jackson plays this guns dealer, and Jackie Brown, the Grier character, is transporting some money from him, gets caught by some ATF agents who are out to get Jackson, and they try to get her to set Jackson's character up. And in the meantime, Jackson's character wants to kill her because he thinks she's going to talk to the cops, but he also needs her to get his money out from Mexico, and she ends up working with the bail bondsman to try and play both sides against each other so that maybe she can come out of it without being killed or put in jail. Tarantino does a really good job of sort of boiling it down to be about the struggle between a few people, mainly the struggle between Jackson's character and Grier's character. Jackson gives a really wonderful performance here. I think his best two performances have both been in Tarantino movies, but this film, Jackson gets to tone it down a little bit, not too much, but a little bit, and he plays an interesting character. He's a thug who's also very smart and intelligent, thinks fast, but he's so used to being the smartest guy around him, because, you know, when you hang out with criminals, you're not really hanging out with brainiacs, that he's not really ready, I think, when he goes up against other smart people in the ATF, and also when he goes up against Jackie Brown. And I think it's really also a movie that's about growing old, as I mentioned before. Jackie Brown is this 44-year-old woman who had a previous run-in with the law and has been reduced to working as a stewardess for a crappy airline, and she's getting old and doesn't know what to do and finds herself in this bad position and has to try and figure out a way to put her past behind her. And at the same time, Samuel L. Jackson's character, also aging, is trying to get out of the business, trying to make one last big score so he can, you know, retire and spend his millions. The Robert Forster character of the bail bondsman is this sort of aged guy who gets drawn into this because he wants to help out the Pam Grier character, and he's the one guy in the movie who sort of serves as an anchor. He seems to have his life together, though maybe he's not as satisfied with his life as he thinks he might be. Now, the look of the movie is fascinating. It looks like a 70s movie, in a way. There's lots of moving shots of characters walking with disco funk playing in the background. Tarantino, I think, you know, very famous for the way he works with pop music, and here he does a great job of doing it. And those are the sorts of shots. Think of Saturday Night Fever, of John Travolta's shoes as he walked through the streets, and, you know, I got a strut, that kind of stuff. Tarantino throws a couple of those moments in here. But we also get these sort of 70s colors. The characters, all of them seem sort of trapped in the 70s. Jackie Brown's apartment looks like it came straight from the 70s, but everything is faded because it takes place in 1997. It's not actually taking place in the 70s. It's a bunch of people who are still stuck in the 70s, and we get the vibrant, weird disco colors, but removed by 30 years as time has worn on them. And it's interesting because all of the main actors in the story are adults. They're middle-aged characters, not something you see a lot of in the movies. Generally speaking, you know, it's very rare to see a female lead who's in her 40s playing a character who's in her 40s. And, you know, Pam Grier looks good. She was actually older than 44. I think she was 47 or 48 when she was filming this. But, you know, she looks like a woman in her 40s. Not something you necessarily see a lot of in Hollywood.
And she hadn't had a role like this in a long time. She, of course, was a star in the 70s. But now, suddenly, she has this great role that Quentin Tarantino has written for her.
Yeah, and, you know, Tarantino has this great habit of bringing back people you haven't seen in a while. John Travolta or David Carradine from his other movies. And he'd wanted to work with Pam Grier for a while, and he finally got to when he wrote a role for her, basically. That's just wonderful. But the movie is not as showy as you might think. It's not like Pulp Fiction or Kill Bill, where he's constantly doing stuff to draw attention to the camera work. There's a one moment where he has a split screen shot, which is something from the 70s, but generally speaking, it looks like a film from the 70s, an American film, where you see a lot of cool camera moves, but it's not necessarily super showy. It's a little more static, very intimate shot. One thing I noticed, I watched it again recently, and it was a little more showier than I remembered, actually, but Tarantino has a real habit in this movie of shooting lots and lots of two shots. That's a shot of two actors in the frame, probably either sides of it, talking to one another, and he has a lot of long takes of two characters just talking, and he likes to use really shallow focus so that only the characters are in focus and you can't see the background, or what he likes to do is put one character in the foreground at one edge of the frame, and another character in the background at the other edge of the frame, and have the character in the foreground in focus while he's talking, and then we lose focus on that character, we get the character who's slightly farther away in focus as he's talking. We get a real intimate sense that we're right there, because of course, if you hold something up close to you, you can't focus on it and things in the background at the same time. So I think the idea is, combined with a lot of real low angles, we get an intimate sense that we are here with these people. And he doesn't use a ton of close-ups or long shots either. When we do get close-ups, they are of people thinking. And Roger Ebert, in his review of the movie in 1997, and he was a critic who just gave it a rave, mentioned that it's one of the few movies where people think. There's a really great moment that Ebert points out late in the film where Samuel L. Jackson realizes he's just been betrayed, more or less, and things aren't going the way it is, and he's trying to figure out if it was the feds who did it, or the Bridget Fonda character, or the Robert De Niro character, or the Pam Grier character, and he sits and he thinks, and the camera pushes it on his face, and we just, for an extended beat, maybe 15, 20 seconds, we just see Samuel L. Jackson with his eyes closed, thinking hard, and he opens them and says, "It's Jackie Brown," and he's figured it out.
Yeah, that's actually my favorite scene in the movie. It's not a scene that, when you're watching it, you say, oh, well, that's obviously my favorite moment, wow, look at that. But something struck me about that, and I couldn't figure out why. And it was later that I read the Ebert review, and I still remember it, you know, almost 10 years later now, and he was saying, because movies don't normally let people think. They have the script. They know what they're going to say, because it's all planned out in advance, and you lose a bit of the improvisation and the sense of the present in a movie that's been prepared in advance. So it is actually quite remarkable that this movie allows characters to think, and that is a great moment with Samuel L. Jackson, definitely a turning point in the whole movie, but it does strike a chord.
I think it helps that Tarantino is casting actors who look like they have some life experience to them. They're not these like fresh-faced, generic Hollywood matinee idols. Robert Forster is in his 50s. He has a worn, weathered face. And when we get a close-up of him just sitting there thinking about something, we get the feeling that, yeah, this is a guy who does stop and think once in a while, who has had some experiences, made some mistakes, and has learned a lot. And it's not something that we necessarily see all that often because movies are so showy. And again, I think it's a throwback to the 70s where movies were more about conversations, where characters were allowed to talk and think and behave more like human beings. Which brings me to the point of the movie, which is, it's about these middle-aged people, or maybe people who are a little bit older than middle-aged, dealing with problems that people have when they're in their 40s or their 50s, you know? Is this what I want to do with my life? Where am I going? I mean, is this where I wanted to be? And I don't think so. I think it's sort of a metaphor. The Jackie Brown character is stuck in the past, trying to still be a flight attendant for this crappy airline, unable to move on. Samuel L. Jackson's character is trying to move ahead, but he's going about it the wrong way. And the Jackie Brown character leans on the Robert Forster character for support, but ultimately she's able to overcome her problems in the right way, and Samuel L. Jackson's character isn't. And I think it's interesting that Quentin Tarantino, he was, I think, 34 when this movie was released. That's pretty young. You don't see a lot of directors in their early 30s making movies like this, especially that nothing in Tarantino's previous filmography, which was just Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, will lead you to think he's going to make a movie like this. Not at all.
Yeah, this is actually my second favorite of Tarantino's movies. Pulp Fiction, of course, is transcendent, but I like Jackie Brown an awful lot. And I'm kind of sensing, as what often happens on this show, we get to talking about the sort of intellectual content and analyze the movie. I don't want to lose anybody. This is a great entertainment, first and foremost. This is a,
absolutely,
you know, it's a con game. It's got the bad guys all chase the suitcase of money kind of a movie. And it certainly has all of the excitement of that. When we say it's low-key, we're talking about in comparison to Kill Bill.
That's a good point.
But it's a lot of fun.
In fact, I was going to mention that with the great script, because we're able to take this really, really complicated plot. There's going to be money in this bag, but we're going to pretend to hand it off because Jackie Brown, of course, is pretending that she's going to be ripping off the feds and pretending to the feds that she's setting up Samuel Jackson and telling Samuel Jackson she's actually just trying to get everyone to get off her case. Well, maybe she can make some money at the same time. Wow. all these different sides, all these different characters interacting. And in fact, there's even a moment where Quentin Tarantino plays with time a little bit. We see this handoff once, then we go back and we see it again from another character's perspective, and then we go back and see it from another character's perspective, and then we realize, oh, that's what the plot was. We actually watched this sequence 3 times because it's so clever and with so many different characters interacting that you need to check it out a couple times to figure out what was going on. And even then, it's not until a little later that you realize precisely what her plan was and how wonderfully executed it was. It's really dazzling to watch. And of course, as usual, Tarantino has some great dialogue. And the dialogue, like I mentioned earlier, is not the pop culture, what do they call a quarter pounder in France, that kind of stuff. One of my favorite lines was, Samuel Jackson has pretty much all the best lines, but he has this great one about the Bridget Fonda character. He says, "You can't trust Melanie, but you can always trust Melanie to be Melanie." And that's his defense for keeping her around. He knows that the Fonda character, Melanie, is going to betray him. But because he knows she's going to betray him, he can keep her around and just plan for it. And that's the sort of great logic that comes from Elmore Leonard's novels. But Tarantino does a great job because Leonard has such a distinctive voice, and so does Tarantino. It's interesting to see the way that Tarantino deals with that dialogue. And I think a lot of the conversations feel more like people talking than Pulp Fiction or Reservoir Dogs. Both those movies are cited for having conversational dialogue. But I don't know, both those movies seem a little pushed up, a little punched up. Jackie Brown, there's lots of circular conversations where characters lose track of what they were saying and they go off on long tangents. There's a really good sequence at the beginning of the movie where Samuel L. Jackson tells this extended lie to another character to get him to come with him. It's just constant, tons and tons of details, and the entire thing is made up. It's not actually true, and that's the sort of great stuff that Tarantino is going to give us, because that's how people talk. You make up details if you're going to tell a lie. In movies, you don't necessarily get that. And he's really able to make complicated things clear. By the end of the movie, we understand exactly what happened and why it happened, and that's something that maybe not a lot of crime thrillers are able to do as succinctly as Tarantino does. He's a really strong writer, and this is probably, in terms of the way it deals with the complexity, one of his best scripts. It's hard to say it's better than Pulp Fiction. Pulp Fiction has more quotable lines, but in a way I think this is a little more mature and interesting script. So yeah, just to sum it up, I think it's witty, it's funny, it's got all the great Tarantino stuff. It does have some of his trademarks, but it's really toned down. It's his least violent film. It's actually less violent than the book in some ways, which is interesting. I think you really want to strip it away and make it more about these characters and less about explosive violence. There are a couple moments of sudden, unexpected violence, as always in Tarantino films, but the complexity of it and the cleverness and the depth to the characters make it a real gem. So as I've said before, if you haven't seen it, go see it. If you have seen it and maybe you didn't really appreciate it the first time because you wanted another Pulp Fiction Reservoir Dogs type movie, go check it out. It's not like his other films at all. One of the biggest joys for me in watching movies is coming across a movie that you thought would not be good, only to find that it's pretty great. So what we want to talk about today are top 6, not top 5, we do one more, top 6 movies that we thought would not be any good that are quite good. So let me get started. My number 6 is The Sixth Sense, the 1999 film by M. Night Shyamalan, which I thought was going to be sort of just weird little, you know, genre horror movie. I saw it opening night only because some friends of mine were going to see it, and I knew almost nothing about it. Back then, of course, we didn't know anything about the director, and I didn't even know that there was going to be a twist ending, so I was completely taken aback and really, really had a good time. I think it's probably the best way to see that movie was to be almost completely cold, thinking that it wouldn't be very good.
Yeah, I knew there was a twist coming, and I was still completely blown away. It just looked to me like an ordinary ghost story. It didn't look anything special at all, and then people were saying, oh yeah, this is really good, this is really good. And my wife likes that kind of movie, so I took her to see it and ended up just having a great time. So it didn't make my list, but I had sort of a similar experience. My number 6 is called Pleasantville from 1998. Now, in 1998, when television ads for Pleasantville started to appear, all I could think of was Hi, Honey, I'm Home, a failed sitcom from 1991 about a 1950s sitcom family that gets transported to the 1990s. Well, it's a gimmick, and the danger with gimmicks is the temptation to rely wholly on that gimmick for your material, and you don't write a good story, for example. So I figured Pleasantville was going to be nothing more than a series of culture clash jokes and maybe people falling down in funny ways. But it's so much more than that. It starts out that way. A couple of kids get transported to a sitcom world in the 1950s, but surprisingly, the movie evolves into a study of social values and freedoms and breaking free of structures that prevent you from being who you are. I should note that I actually very much disagree with a lot of what this movie has to say, both on moral and philosophical grounds. But I love how this movie encourages thought and does so while remaining funny.
Yeah, definitely. A good pick. I think I had a little higher expectations for it, but I was also surprised that it wasn't just a simple comedy or even just a simple satire. It's a really effective character study and a pretty good drama at that. My number five pick is a little less highbrow. It's Batman Begins from 2005 by Christopher Nolan. And this was a movie that I think I owe you an apology on. Because while it was in production, we kept talking about it. And I kept insisting that it was going to be awful, that there was no way we were ever going to get a good Batman movie. And about the time the first trailer came out, I think I said to Sam, all right, maybe I'm wrong. And I ended up seeing it and just loving it and being impressed that somehow Christopher Nolan got through the Warner Brothers system and got us a great psychological Batman flick.
Yeah, it is kind of surprising. Warner Brothers has a history of interfering too much with the superhero movies, but they understood to take their hands off of this one. You know, Christopher Nolan is such a great director and good with the psychological thriller angle, and that's who Batman is. He is a psychologically disturbed hero in thriller stories, so I just figured Nolan was the perfect guy for this. Of course, I also thought Ang Lee would just do a fantastic job with Hulk, so, you know, you win some, you lose some. My number five, also a little less highbrow, it's called School of Rock from 2003. It's a comedy starring Jack Black. I had utterly no interest in seeing this. It looked like one of those big, dumb, witless comedies where the actors get drunk and, you know, fall over in funny ways. And that's as sophisticated as the jokes get. But I was so wrong. This is a highly entertaining movie, a rare broad comedy that's not only funny, but gets you to care about its characters. I think what makes it work is the fact that it's not just about the party, rock and roll lifestyle. The central character is somebody who is genuinely passionate about rock and roll music, and its enthusiasm is what drives the story forward.
Yeah, absolutely a surprise, especially considering Jack Black movies have historically not been so great. My number four movie is also a comic book adaptation from last year, and that's Sin City from 2005, directed by Robert Rodriguez. I generally think that comic book movies are going to be terrible, and I don't really like Robert Rodriguez to boot, and somehow Sin City ended up being my favorite movie of 2005. I think it's a brilliant film, incredibly well shot, with the most interesting and unique visuals I've ever seen in a movie. It's some sort of noir on speed, and I absolutely love every minute of it.
Okay, my number four is called Holes from 2003, and it's an adaptation of a children's book that stars John Voight and Sigourney Weaver. I couldn't imagine what would be less interesting than a bunch of kids digging holes in the ground, but you know what? This is really, really good. The story actually gets quite involved, tying together plot threads that occur over 100 years. The attention to detail and the way a lot of the incidental clues come together in the end make this an immensely satisfying movie, and not just for kids, for adults as well.
Interesting. Well, I'm going to go back up highbrow now. My number third movie is The Seventh Seal, Ingmar Bergman's 1957 classic film that I really thought was going to be terrible, pretentious, stuffy, and overbearing, and I was really, really wrong. It's a very interesting, very allegorical movie that is about a lot of things, including some weighty subjects, death and life and the meaning of life and what we do with our time here on Earth. But it's always interesting. It never stops being compelling and moves quickly, and despite all the weird symbolism, works pretty well. I love it.
Yeah, it's interesting that I don't think we're getting a whole lot of older movies on this, because I think by the time we hear about the classics, we already know that they're at least supposed to be good. This is one that I think I agree with you. I think I wasn't expecting to enjoy this as much as I did. I think I was expecting to admire it, maybe, but not really enjoy it. My number three, I knew about a year or two in advance of its release, and I dreaded it the entire time. It's a science fiction film, and the two actors attached to it were Keanu Reeves and Val Kilmer. I think Reeves is usually pretty terrible, and Kilmer isn't my favorite actor either, and all I could think about was the horrible Johnny Mnemonic that Reeves would have sunk with his wooden acting had it been afloat in the first place. Well, eventually Kilmer dropped out, and Lawrence Fishburne replaced him, and The Matrix came out and absolutely dazzled me. It's a suspense ride, and had the visual style that had never been seen before. It got parodied so much and so immediately that it's hard to remember just how fresh this all was when it came out. Actually, the thing where the camera swivels around, the two combatants frozen in midair, had been done in Gap commercials before this with some teenagers dancing, but this was the first time the trick had appeared in a movie, despite that the required technology had been around since the beginning of film. Anyway, even apart from the special effects, this was really just a great and involving movie, and I was so not expecting it.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting it either. I wasn't down on it at all, because I didn't really know anything about it. I just sort of saw it on opening day or the day after. I think it opened in the middle of the week, and I caught it like on a Thursday. And I wasn't expecting anything other than an action movie, and I liked it quite a bit. A very, very impressive film. Yeah, and I do think we've had a lot of newer movies on the list. My number two is also fairly recent, but it's one of my favorite films from the 90s, and for some reason, I don't know why, I was convinced for a long time that it wasn't actually very good, and that's The Shawshank Redemption from 1994 by Frank Darabont. Obviously now everyone recognizes it as a classic, but when it came out, I remember just thinking, oh, well, I mean, it's a prison movie. It got nominated for a couple of Oscars, including, I think, Best Picture, but you didn't really hear a lot about it. It wasn't until video and television, really, that I started hearing a lot of good things about it. And by the time I finally got around to seeing it, I figured, well, it's been overblown, but it's the sort of movie that until you watch it, you can't really get what's so great about it. It's involving, but it's slow, and it draws you into a world that you're not expecting to be as interesting as it is.
Yeah, there's a segment in the middle of that that keeps me from calling it the great movie everyone else is, and it's a comparatively slow sequence, even for this movie, kind of a downer. You come out of it kind of depressed and not really understanding what the point is. I mean, I get what the point is, but on an emotional level. But everything else about this movie is quite involving, very compelling, pretty exciting to see the main character cope through everything he's done and then realize at the end all the things he's been doing all along. My top two movies are both movies I thought would be terrible as I was watching them. In fact, I gave up on my number two pick after about 20 minutes and went to bed, only returning to it later because my father inexplicably kept telling me I should. It's called The Gods Must Be Crazy from 1980, a pretty unique movie from, of all people, a South African nature documentarian. And indeed, it starts out looking like it's going to be a weird documentary, specifically about the Bushman tribes in the Kalahari Desert. And then a pilot drops a Coke bottle out of a plane as he flies overhead, and the Bushmen don't know what it is or what to do with it, and it's just weird. Then it makes the strangest cut to a group of rebels who want to overthrow the government, and they just bust into a building and shoot some officials, and I'm thinking, what the heck is all this? But it turns out that these plot threads and others all wind up making a sort of sense, and ultimately it actually becomes one of the funniest movies I've ever seen. And now when I rewatch it, I'm tuned into the unique rhythm of this movie, and even these opening scenes are entertaining as well. This is a great movie and special because of how original it is.
You know, with that movie, I feel like the Bushmen looking at the Coke bottle, I don't know what to do with it. I don't really get it, so I appreciate that a lot of people do, but alright, that's your decision. My number one movie is an absolute classic that is going to need some explaining for me to explain why I thought it was going to suck. I saw it when I was, I think, 17 or 18, just in college in a cinema class. At that point in time, you know, you're 17, 18-year-old kid, you think you hate musicals. And I was absolutely convinced that I was going to hate Singin' in the Rain. And I saw it, and it convinced me that, in fact, not only do I perhaps like musicals, but they can be absolutely great. And ever since I've seen it, it's been one of my favorite films. I've watched it, I don't know, a dozen times. I put it on whenever I'm in a bad mood, and it cheers me up. It's funny, it's great, and it's just, even today, even if you're an 18-year-old guy sitting in a film class not really wanting to watch the movie that you're supposed to be watching, I think it can win you over. It certainly did for me.
Absolutely. That may be one of the best movies we're going to talk about. The movie I'm going to talk about for my number one is not nearly that great, but I picked it because I hit the 50-minute mark in watching this movie before I had any idea that it was going to be any good. It's a movie called Funny Bones, and, you know, I was wondering if I'd live through it. I've never experienced a more dramatic reversal of opinion while watching a movie, especially having already gotten that far into it. It's a comedy drama about a couple of vaudeville performers and how they cope with their past. There's also a kind of a lame subplot about, well, eggs, dust, and youth. But if you stick with it, the main story changes from bizarre and downright torturous to something that's immensely satisfying and quite funny, and artful, even. It's also wonderfully inventive with its visual style. It reminds me of something Terry Gilliam or Jean-Pierre Genet might have made.
Interesting. I don't think I've ever heard of this movie.
Probably not, yeah.
When was it made?
1995.
Huh.
And, you know, I just saw it sitting on a video shelf, and then I saw some cast members that looked pretty good, so I picked it up. It was a completely random choice there.
Sometimes those completely random picks, I tend to see them on HBO rather than on the video shelves. They work out well, and it's a nice surprise. And that's sort of why we're doing this. So I think definitely... Yes. It's a good reminder to always sometimes give movies a chance, even if you think you won't like them.
Yeah.
So let's recap. My top six movies that I thought would not be any good that were. Number six is The Sixth Sense by M. Night Shyamalan from 1999. Number five is 2005's Batman Begins. Number 4 is another comic book film, Sin City, from the same year. Number 3, The Seventh Seal, from 1957. Number 2, The Shawshank Redemption, from 94. And number 1 movie that I thought would not be any good that was, Singin' in the Rain, from 1952.
And on my list, number 6, Pleasantville, from 1998. Number 5, School of Rock, from 2003. Number 4, Holes, from 2003 as well. Number 3, The Matrix, from 1999. Number 2, The Gods Must Be Crazy, from 1980. And number 1, Funny Bones, 1995.
And I'm sure everyone is going to be rushing out to rent Funny Bones if we can find a copy that exists somewhere. I'm not sure the movie's real. I think I made it up just for this list.
We are already halfway through November, but we do want to spotlight some DVD releases that will be happening in this month and have already happened. Originally, we were going to cover releases from both November and December, but it turns out that nothing any good at all is coming out in December, so this will be a November-only DVD preview. And my first pick came out last week on November 7th. It's called The Flower Drum Song, probably the least well-known of the Rodgers and Hammerstein musicals, which include Oklahoma and Carousel, The King and I, The Sound of Music, South Pacific, all those kinds of things. So if you like those, and you've never heard of The Flower Drum Song, which is, I suspect, not going to be uncommon, then you may be interested in checking out The Flower Drum Song. All of the others have been released on DVD before, but this one is owned by a different studio, and so it was not released in the new boxed set of re-released Rodgers and Hammerstein musicals that also came out last week. The Flower Drum Song is a standalone DVD, released on DVD for the first time, and so if you're a fan of those other musicals, you may want to give this one a shot.
Well, my first pick also came out last week on the 7th, and it's the re-release, the third re-release of Cinema Paradiso, the great Italian movie about the movies from 1989 by director Giuseppe Tornatore. And it's an interesting film about a young boy and growing up in post-war Italy and his love affair with the movies and how he goes from being a young kid working in a projection booth in a small Italian town to being a major film director and about sort of the small town life growing up there at that time and place. Now, this is the third DVD release. Like I mentioned, the first DVD release was just a pretty bare bones disc. The second one had some decent special features, including both cuts of the movie, the international cut and the shorter American release. And it's actually one of the cases where I think most people who've seen both of them prefer the shorter version. Harvey Weinstein cut out some of the film when he released it when he was over at Miramax, and I actually think the shorter one works better. The new disc is a 3-disc set, so that'll be nice, and it has better artwork than the old special edition, which had just a terrible artwork on it. Didn't represent the movie at all. If you don't have it, this would be a good time to pick it up, and if you want to save a few bucks, I'm sure that the old special edition, which had both cuts on it as well, will be a bit cheaper.
Okay, well, my next pick is probably predictable to a lot of you. It's the James Bond Ultimate Collection. The first two of four box sets were released last week on November 7th. The next two come on December 12th, so I guess we do have a December release in here. Half of one item. Anyway, the James Bond Ultimate Collection of DVDs features the first 20 official Bond films spread out across 40 discs, so each movie gets two DVDs, one for the movie and one for the special features, things like deleted scenes and TV specials and screen test, alternate angles for selected scenes and that sort of thing. Each movie has at least one commentary, some two, some of them newly recorded. I believe Roger Moore recorded new commentaries for all of his, for example. Some of them came from previous releases. But perhaps more importantly to many of you, the movies have all undergone frame-by-frame restoration by Lowry Digital. And here's another improvement upon previously releases. They all have 5.1 DTS sound now. And in the case of the early mono Connery movies, that meant going all the way back to the original sound sources and remixing them basically from scratch. Supposedly they sound fantastic. I haven't heard them yet. But as I said, the first two box sets were released on November 7th, and the next two come out December 12th. For some reason, the movies are out of order totally. Each set has sort of like a random selection, so if you do get them all, rearrange them, because you don't want them on the shelf like that.
I'm sure I'll set you back a couple bucks to get them all, but
probably.
It's nice that they went back and restored them, because they've been released on DVD a couple times before, but man, they haven't been. The DVDs have been kind of subpar for the Bond series, so I think this will probably be like the definitive DVD collections.
I suspect so, yeah.
Well, speaking of DVD collections, my next pick is coming out next week on the 21st, and that is the filmmaker collection of Preston Sturges. It contains seven of his great screwball comedies. He was a writer and director who directed some of the best screwball comedies for a brief period of time in the late 30s, early 40s, and then kind of dropped off and didn't really make a whole lot in his later life. But this has his absolute best. The collection consists of The Lady Eve, Sullivan's Travels, The Palm Beach Story, Hail the Conquering Hero, The Great McGinty, The Christmas in July, and The Great Moment. It's too bad it doesn't include Miracle at Morgan's Creek, which is one of his hilarious movies, but Sturges' comedies are really known for being really fast-paced screwball comedies, hold up pretty well today, and particularly Lady Eve and Sullivan's Travels are probably his two most respected films. Both of those already existed on really nice Criterion Collection DVDs, so I mean, I own both of them. I feel I kind of want to buy this collection, but at the same time, it's like I already own two of them, but I have a feeling I'm going to end up picking up anyway, just because it's great to have all these other sort of lesser Sturges movies released on DVD finally. Well worthwhile if you like classic comedy.
Absolutely, and I would actually argue that The Palm Beach Story is one of his stronger movies. I have a soft spot for that one, but definitely The Lady Eve is, I think, both of our favorites. My next pick is released today on November 14th. It is the Looney Tunes Golden Collection Volume 4. This is the fourth year in a row now that Warner Brothers has released a four-DVD pack of their classic Looney Tunes cartoons. These are spectacular collections, very nicely packaged and loaded with, you know, a lot of interesting extras. A lot of extras on DVDs aren't so great. This one has a lot of really nice documentaries, things about the making, and also about how the cartoons are put together and why they were and the circumstances of their development and that kind of things. You'd think by Volume 4, though, they'd be running out of good cartoons to put in these collections. But, you know, there are still 700 or so in the vault. They're just so prolific, and most of them were quite good. As always, stick to the four-disc golden collections and avoid the two-disc spotlight collections. Even though they're cheaper, they are just slimmed-down versions of the golden ones. I think they take a couple of the DVDs out of the four and package them separately. These cartoons are really great. It's unbelievable how smart and funny and imaginative they are, and enduringly entertaining no matter how old you are or how many times you've seen them all before.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really nice that they're taking such good care of those. The DVD releases have all, I think, been really well received. So it's good to see these sort of things that are very important to our history and our culture. I'm glad to see them taking time with them. Well, my next pick also comes out next week on the 21st. It's a little less substantial than some of the other movies we've been talking about, but it's hilarious nonetheless. It's a re-release of A Fish Called Wanda, which has been out on a couple releases, so it's another one of those instances where maybe you'll want to use this good excuse to pick up a cheaper, older version or to get the new, lots of special features, I don't know. But it's a hilarious, dark comedy starring lots of great actors, including John Cleese and Kevin Kline, Jamie Lee Curtis. It's got sort of a Monty Python feel to it a little bit, that great, dry British humor, and it's a caper movie with lots of silliness. And I know that both Sam and I are big fans of it. It's a good comedy. If you like that sort of dry, subtle, dark British humor, you'll enjoy it a lot. A lot of good jokes about the differences between British people and Americans, and it works out pretty well.
Yeah, you say subtle, and it is does have a lot of subtle humor, but a lot of it is very outspoken, so it's like a clash of styles that somehow works.
Right. Like I said, it has almost so many Monty Python alumni, it does almost feel like that sort of Python style where it's over the top and also subtle at the same time.
Yeah.
Like the same joke can work on two different levels.
Yeah. Well, my last pick comes out on November 28th, and it is half an old movie and half a new movie. It's Superman II, The Richard Donner Cut. I need to give a little backstory to explain what this is. In 1977, director Richard Donner set about filming two Superman movies simultaneously. Finished off the first one, and we know what that is today, and he had also gotten about 75% done with shooting the second when he was fired by the producers due to a number of different tensions with their working relationship, many of them having to do with issues of control over the final project, and Donner wanted a lot of creative control. He wanted it to be his movie. They wanted it to be more campy, for example, and Donner didn't want that at all. So a new director, Richard Lester, was brought in, and he had never even heard of Superman, but they got him to shoot some more comic scenes, and he edited the thing together. Actually, he reshot a lot of the Richard Donner footage, and the result is that most of Superman II is his movie. That's why his name is the sole directorial credit, because under the rules, he had shot more than 50% of the movie, so he got the directorial credit. As it turned out, Steven disagrees. As it turned out, I think the theatrical cut of Superman II came out really well. Definitely better than you'd expect under the circumstances of its development. Of course, Lester would go on to make the absolutely terrible Superman 3, and it's been a regret of fans that Donner couldn't have finished off Superman 2 the way he wanted to. Well, the forthcoming Richard Donner's cut of Superman 2 is a total re-edit of Superman 2, supervised by Richard Donner, and restoring the movie to as close to the way he originally wanted it to be as possible. Much of the Lester footage will be removed. A lot of unused Donner footage will be reinstated, including the famous Marlon Brando footage, along with Donner's directorial credit for the film. Supposedly, the amount of Lester footage will be reduced from about 70% of the original cut to less than 25%. So this will be a substantially different movie than the one we're familiar with. It's almost like getting a new movie. By the way, just a quick note, also on the same day, there'll be a box set release of the Christopher Reeve Superman movies. I think it's 8 discs. 4 discs are devoted just to the first movie, 2 for the second, and 1 each for the third and fourth, which you can throw away. But the Richard Donner cut is not included, so if you want that, you have to get it separately. But I definitely...
So wait, if you buy that set, basically... you get stuck with Superman's 2, 3, and 4 and get Superman 1.
Yes, you get stuck with 3 and 4 in order to get 1 and 2.
No, because you see, the Richard Lester version, I don't know about the Donner version, but the Richard Lester version of Superman 2 is not a good movie.
But see, I can...
A lot of people mistakenly think it is.
You know, here at All Movie Talk, we are having a free giveaway of street cred, so if you just like some during the segment, Steven is just happy to give you his.
I'm glad these movies are coming out on DVD, Sam, so that you can go and take a look at them again, and I think all the people who love Superman 2 just haven't seen it since they were 12.
I think you're getting hung up on a couple of flaws.
Some
of Lester's footage, he did have some goofy gags in there that worked when I was a kid. Don't work for me anymore.
Goofy gags. But that's it. There's no tension. No,
that's an overreaction.
Oh, man. Kneel before Zod. Look, it's not actually good. It's just cheesy and iconic, but... Well, I'm actually interested to see if the Donner version is actually better, because Donner is actually a pretty good director.
Yeah, he is. And that is true. So to recap, my 4 DVD picks for November and a little bit of December. On November 7th, The Flower Drum Song, and also the first 2 box set releases of the James Bond Ultimate Collection. The final 2 box sets from this series will be released on December 12th. Also, on November 14th, that's today, the Looney Tunes Golden Collection Volume 4, and November 28th, Superman 2, The Richard Donner Cut.
November 7th, I have Cinema Paradiso, which of course came out last week, and a week from today I have the Preston Sturges Filmmaker Collection that consists of The Lady Eve, Sylvan's Travels, The Palm Beach Story, Hail the Conquering Hero, The Great McGinty, Christmas in July, and The Great Moment, as well as on that same day a re-release of A Fish Called Wanda. And you can go and just add on the following week Superman Returns, which is of course the DVD release of this summer Superman movie, which is actually a much, much, much better film than Superman 2. Yeah.
Sorry.
Okay.
Earlier in the show, I told an anecdote about a director that I did not name. A brief recap, 2 French writers wrote the novel that the film Les Diaboliques was based on, and a certain French director asked them to write a novel for him to film, and the book was called From Among the Dead, and the movie version of it is an incredibly famous and admired film. Steven, do you have any guess as to who this mystery director is?
Now, this is a French director?
No, it's not a French director.
Okay, is it Hitchcock?
It is Alfred Hitchcock, and the movie was Vertigo. When Les Diaboliques came out, it was very reminiscent of Hitchcock's work, just as accomplished and suspenseful. There's a great story here. A man reportedly wrote a letter to Hitchcock and said, "Sir, after seeing Diabolique, my daughter was afraid to take a bath. Now she has seen your Psycho and is afraid to take a shower. What should I do with her?" And Hitchcock wrote back and suggested that he send her to the dry cleaners.
That was as great of an episode as I hoped it would be, but unfortunately, the projector sound means that we're all pretty much wrapped up here. But be sure and check out our website, which is never all wrapped up, and that website is allmovietalk.com. As always, you know the name of the show, All Movie Talk. You know the website, allmovietalk.com.
Also, check out rinkworks.com, rankworks.com. There's a bunch of movie reviews. I think there's over 2,000 movie reviews there, and also some other movie-related features. Next week, we're going to be talking about some great stuff. We're going to talk about the sequel to our James Bond series. We'll just talk about Casino Royale after Steven and I have seen it in the theater. We'll also start a new series that will be recapping the best movies throughout cinema history. It's a pretty ambitious undertaking, and of course we'll have a new top 6 list, so tune in next week. Thanks for listening. Your local news is next. Good night.
cut and print.